Station.
It's 1 o'clock.
91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. Today's program begins with a look at interpersonal relationships and how some people use dysfunctional relationships to hide from intimacy. Good afternoon. It's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. Our guest is practicing psychiatrist Dr. Grant Brenner. He's written a book on what he terms irrelationships. He asks, why does it take a moment to fall in love but 10 years to get out of it? That's in minutes. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining. She'll visit with some local restaurant and craft beer folks to celebrate National Burger Month. Stay with us. Topical Currents up next after a roundup of national and local news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The GOP is expressing optimism about its chances of unifying, evident in a joint statement issued by House Speaker Paul Ryan and Donald Trump, the apparent presidential nominee, whom Ryan has long criticized as a divisive figure. After their meeting this morning, Ryan says there's a chance of ensuring that despite differences, Trump and his former critics will be able to agree on the party's core principles.
I do believe that we are now planting the seeds to get ourselves unified, to bridge the gaps and differences. And so from here, we're going to go deeper into the policy areas to see where that common ground is and how we can make sure that we are operating off these same core principles.
However, Ryan says more meetings will be had, so for now he still is not endorsing Trump for president. The longest-serving Republican in the Senate is throwing his support behind Trump, though. However, Orrin Hatch, the lawmaker from Utah, says Trump needs to dial down his campaign rhetoric. He notes that many of his constituents have, quote, serious reservations about the billionaire businessman. Hatch is among several Republican leaders due to meet with GOP's de facto nominee later today. Supporters turn out for Brazil's embattled president Dilma Rousseff as she is removed from office. Rousseff is vowing to fight lawmakers' decision to move ahead with an impeachment process. NPR's Lulu Garcia Navarro reports from the capital, Brasilia, that the former president struck a defiant note in her farewell address to the nation.
Dilma Rousseff stood on the steps of the presidential palace, pumping her fist in the air and calling on her supporters to take to the streets to challenge what she says is a coup. But analysts here say leftist Dilma Rousseff is unlikely to return to power after the Senate voted to remove her from office, pending a trial that will look at whether she should be impeached for violating accounting laws. Her former vice president, right-leaning Michel Temer, is now president, and he's named part of his cabinet. All white men in a country where 53% of the population is Afro-Brazilian and half are female. Top of his agenda is getting the economy back on track. Brazil is in the midst of an historic recession. Markets reacted positively to the change in leadership, with the Brazilian currency strengthening. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Brasilia.
Recent economic studies find the middle class on the decline. A new study by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center examined metro areas to see where the middle class was hurting most. NPR's Marilyn Giewax has details of the findings.
What this study really shows is that the middle class has been shrinking in nearly every metropolitan area. But, you know, it's not just that people are getting poorer. A lot of people are getting richer. The problem here is that the upper class is growing and the lower class is growing. It's the middle class that's really been shrinking.
NPR's Marilyn Giewax. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was down 18 points at 17,692. This is NPR.
From the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald, I'm Christine DiMatte. The Smithsonian Institution says it has no interest in buying the gun that former Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman used in the fatal shooting of Trayvon Martin. Zimmerman says the gun is going up for auction online and that the Smithsonian had expressed interest. In related news, there's a play in Philadelphia that chronicles the last few moments of the life of Florida teenager Martin before he was shot and killed by Zimmerman in 2012. The play is called The Ballad of Trayvon Martin. 16-year-old actor Amir Randall, who portrays Martin, was 12 years old when Martin was killed. Randall says he learned about Martin through the play, learned a lot about Martin through the play.
I didn't know really anything about him. I just knew his name, where he was from, and what happened to him. Going through the play, I realized he's someone like me. He wants to be a pilot. I want to, you know, be in the Air Force. He had a girlfriend. You know, everybody wants to talk to girls.
Director Rajendra Ramun Maharaj says he wrote the play 6 months after Zimmerman was acquitted of Martin's death in 2013.
If there's any lesson from this play, it is that we are more alike than different, but there are differences, and we can only truly move ahead as a country if we acknowledge our shared painful past.
The Ballad of Trayvon Martin debuts tonight in Philly and will run through May 22nd. No word yet on plans to bring the show to Florida. The federal government wants to know what Floridians are more afraid of, the Zika virus or a plan to kill disease-carrying mosquitoes by releasing genetically engineered bugs. The public has until midnight tomorrow to weigh in. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration will then decide whether or not a British biotech firm can release the GMO mosquitoes near Key West. The plan is to release non-biting male mosquitoes modified to produce offspring that do not survive. Fear is a common theme in the nearly 2,000 comments posted online so far, but there's a split over what is more frightening, birth defects linked to Zika or genetic engineering. This is WLRN Miami Herald News. I'm Christine DiMattei.
Support for NPR comes from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, all with a commitment to putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com.
And we're back. It is today's topical occurrence. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Thursday afternoon. Well, we opened today's program with discussion of a new book about relationships. It's called Irrelationships: How We Use Dysfunctional Relationships to Hide from Intimacy.
It expounds on a psychological defense system which two or more people may maintain in order to avoid awareness anxiety, which more simply put is fears of intimacy and emotional attachment and investment.
So with us now is one of the co-authors of the book. He's psychiatrist Dr. Grant Brenner, who practices in New York City. He's joining us by phone. Welcome to you, Dr. Grant Brenner. Could you speak up a little bit? You're a little bit off the phone there.
Thanks very much for having me.
There we go.
Good to have you. So you say that our brains actually produce bonding chemicals that make us care for a partner unconditionally who might be unhealthy for us. So why, from an evolutionary standpoint, would we produce those chemicals?
So usually what that does is it allows for the species to propagate, right?
Right.
So people need to bond and they need to stay together in order to raise children. And that is really important. However, when people get close to one another and they've got a history with some kind of trauma in their family, it can keep them together and prevent them from being able to deal with problems that come up.
Well, again, from an evolutionary standpoint, perhaps it was unsafe to reveal ourselves and allow for intimacy because all that was required was procreation. So in that sense, all we needed was momentary love, right? Not intimacy that would last a lifetime. I'm still speaking of evolutionary standpoint.
Right. Well, human beings have this protracted period of development. It's a long development. Some animals, all that's required is relatively brief mating, mm-hmm. and it's not required for both of the partners to stay together. Or some animals essentially are born prepared to survive, or they're born in such great numbers that the evolutionary strategy is more like playing the odds, hoping 1 in 100 survives, like sea turtles, for example. But human beings are born not very well equipped to function in the world, and we can get along with one primary caregiver, but it helps a lot to have two, let alone a community. And usually we don't reach emotional maturity in the olden days, you know, until early teens, but nowadays things have really shifted. Culture has developed a great deal, and human beings in educated societies, you know, don't reach maturity until late teens, early 20s. So it's really essential to have the long-term bonding in place. Scientists study small animals usually to study bonding, and they often look at voles, which are kind of a small rodent, Prairie voles are long-term bonding animals compared with some other small animals which mate and then leave. And human beings seem to have more of an attachment system that it's geared toward long-term bonding because of the evolutionary need to stick around to raise kids into adulthood.
The book uses the term epigenetic factors. Could you explain that more?
Yeah, this is a really interesting understanding that's come up only in the last decade or so. People are very familiar with nature versus nurture. Now, nature is usually thought of as genetic factors that don't change. You're born with it, and it is what it is. Nurture, of course, is the effect of the environment, but what we've learned is that the way that DNA is actually read is changed based on environmental factors that happened before the person was born. So there have been large epidemiologic studies where they look at people who were born to parents or grandparents in groups that had undergone starvation, and they have different levels of neurotransmitters and different reactions around food and hunger. In Holocaust survivors, children and grandchildren, there's been a lot of study that the way stress is processed is altered if the parents and grandparents had experienced considerable stress. The main way that this happens is thought to be through masking what are called promoter regions of DNA. Promoter regions are a bit like a dimmer switch. You can turn it up or you can turn it down, make more or less of a protein, and epigenetic factors can either mask or unmask the promoter region and change the expression of the genes. So environment and nature are directly interacting in epigenetic factors.
So our parents' backgrounds can influence how we begin to develop as children.
Yeah, from the epigenetic point of view, biologically, directly can affect it. But certainly in psychology and in trauma theory, there's a great deal of understanding of what is usually called intergenerational or transgenerational transmission of trauma. And while epigenetic factors can transmit traumatic experience, culture and social learning are also a huge way that things are transmitted down the generations, including patterns of relatedness.
Well, I'd like to get more to the ear relationship. You say there are two roles. There's the performer and the audience. So explain who's who.
Okay, thanks for bringing that up. So if ear relationship is a shared defense that serves to avoid anxiety, the performer and the audience are playing opposite roles in this drama that we call the song and dance routine in the book. The performer is trying to take care of the audience in ways that are essentially doomed to fail. And the performer is trying harder and harder to take care of the audience. The audience job, by contrast, is to make sure, and this is all largely unconscious, the audience job is to make sure that the performer is not successful. This allows the pattern to continue.
Okay, could you give us a specific example, like
in a common relationship?
Yeah, a very common problem. Yeah.
So I'll come back to where that starts in childhood, which will make it easier to understand. But a common example would be a man who is very depressed, and a woman who is trying to get him to get his depression better. And so we're not talking about traditional biological depression that responds to medical treatment, but kind of a reactive depression that's connected with a lot of complicated factors. So he's very depressed, and there's nothing she can do to help. She tries to do everything. She gets him a membership to a gym. She tries to make an appointment for him to see a therapist. And part of her job is to try to be a caregiver here.
Right.
And it doesn't work. And essentially the two of them get into a position where their whole relationship is organized around him being sick and her trying to save him. And what's happening in the background is that any kind of real intimacy between them is dwindling, you know, more and more as this goes on. Eventually, the performer, you know, for example, will often get very frustrated and give up.
Is this related to codependency?
Codependency is is a part of the equation here. Codependency is something that usually applies to one person. So one of the people in an IR relationship may have codependent traits, for sure. And the other person may have what's often called counterdependency. Counterdependency is when someone is in denial of their need for other people and they act excessively self-sufficient.
Is there generally a gender breakdown to the performer in the audience in heterosexual relationships I'm talking about?
I don't believe so. It's tempting to think oftentimes, you know, men are the fixers. But that isn't always the case. It certainly hasn't been predominantly the case in the couples that we have worked with.
Well, women are the caretakers, right? Usually.
Yeah, exactly, because women can be the caretakers. So it can shift in either direction. It really depends on the family of origin. That's where we start talking about the childhood origins of your relationship.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, quickly, radio@WLRN.org.
If you're in an IR relationship, are you a performer or the audience? And do you want true intimacy, but you're too fearful, or do you prefer the comfort of your current relationship? Which, Dr. Brenner, I want to ask you about. If intimacy often creates such overwhelming anxiety in many people, what's the reason for having it? I mean, what are the benefits of it? Why should they work out these underlying issues? So I guess there are two questions. One is, if it creates such anxiety, what is the benefit? And two, just generally, what are the benefits of intimacy?
Yeah, well, to some extent, we're social creatures. And, of course, every person is different. Not everyone has the same need for intimacy. But in general, part of what is required for us to be happy, satisfied people is to have close, satisfying relationships with other people. And your relationship, by the way, doesn't have to apply to romantic relationships only.
Right.
So we focus on that in the book. So social relatedness is just as important for happiness and survival as are things like food, water, and meaningful, productive activity like work. So that's sort of the first part of it, is that that's the way we're wired. We're born with an attachment system, and that's what we need as social animals. But intimacy offers a lot of things beyond that. It can be very rewarding to share deeply with another person. It can be part of a personal journey. Going through life with a partner who's really there with you is an enriching and rewarding experience for a great many people. Of course, not everyone is really desirous of having a long-term relationship for the whole course of their lifespan, and I think that has shifted a little bit as marriage has shifted in modern culture. But still, the rewards of being close to another person, being able to share of oneself and with the other person, is something that many people find deeply gratifying.
I'm thinking that some people think that maintaining the status quo, staying in what you refer to as their carefully constructed hiding place, even though it's unconscious, maybe that works for them. I can understand there are a lot of benefits of intimacy, but I mean, you've just gone through some of them. Explain this dissociative behavior, how it relates to this.
Yes, yeah, certainly. And by the way, I agree with you. There are people who are happy in their relationships without growing closer and closer. That's a certain ideal that isn't for everyone. And we've certainly had people write into our blog and say, I've been married for 20 or 30 years, and we have kind of a safe relationship, and it works for both of us. What's wrong with that? And the answer is nothing is wrong with that. But being aware of what you're doing has something to say for it.
I'm going to take that question about dissociative behavior, because we need to go to a short break, but we'll get to it as soon as we get back. We're speaking with Dr. Grant Brenner. He's a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and consultant in private practice in New York City. He and two other doctors, Dr. Mark Borg and Daniel Berry, have written IR Relationship. We'll be right back.
The Miami-Lisbon Dance Exchange brings together companies from Portugal with Florida's own Karen Peterson and dancers, integrating performers with and without disabilities, tonight and tomorrow at Miami-Dade County Auditorium. Tickets in advance through Ticketmaster.
Hi, I'm Michael Stock. Every Sunday on Folk and Acoustic Music, I bring you the best in contemporary and traditional bluegrass, blues, old-time music, and folk music, plus live music in the studio, this week with Quarter Bones, Matt Calderon, Blue Sky Drive, and The Fortune Tellers. The Public Storyteller with Dr. Karen Neal is at 4 o'clock, Folk and Acoustic Music Sunday, starting at 2.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. Thursday edition, we resume our conversation with psychiatrist Dr. Grant Brenner. Bonnie, you had a dissociative question.
Yes, to explain, you know, dissociative behavior. And it's, I guess, much like the rest of not being able to be intimate. Right, doctor?
Yeah. That's a very good question. A lot of people are becoming more familiar with the idea of trauma. Dissociation is a reaction to very intense experience that a person cannot make sense of. And dissociation can be very, very extreme, such as completely becoming unaware of something, forgetting something that happened, being unaware of important life events, if it started early in childhood, to a much less extreme presentation, like tuning out little things, forgetting things that are stressful, or even becoming very, very absorbed into what a person is doing to the exclusion of awareness of other things. When it's problematic is when the need to use dissociation in an extreme way keeps the person from being aware of things about other people and themselves that they need to be aware of, such as important information about emotions in the case of a relationship or what one's desires are to truly be satisfied. In a relationship, if a person is cutting off those parts of themselves, they're going to feel more and more unhappy without quite knowing why.
But is that necessarily true? If one is in a relationship and really doesn't seek all that much intimacy, does that preclude being happy?
No, that's...
It depends on the person. You know, the people who are interested in our work are people who have an intrinsic desire to experience greater intimacy. I think people who are either have a lower need for intimacy from other people or who genuinely find satisfaction in other activities aren't going to be finding our work as useful. Having said that, though, there are people who dissociate their need for intimacy and throw themselves into something like work and then realize later on that they missed out on opportunities for closeness and really feel regret or grief over that. That's what's so tricky about it, because what a person is aware of at a given moment is sometimes accurate, but as we know with, for example, people who realize many, many years later that they had always been gay and didn't know it, people can also not be aware of things that are important for them until it's too late. So essentially, we want to give people the opportunity to give it some more thought and maybe some tools to explore themselves and see if it really is what it seems like in the present moment.
Well, now that we've identified what you say or what we know could be a problem for many, let's focus on the ways of breaking free, which you do in your book. You use something called the dream sequence. Tell us what that is.
Okay, the dream sequence, it's an acronym. It stands for discovery, repair, which is interactive, empowerment, alternatives, and mutuality. So the first thing we do in the book is we give people tools for communication so that they can start to dialogue with one another and feel a greater level of compassion and intimacy for one another and create a space for communication that's not judgmental, that's not accusatory, and they can learn to see fights and use fights and arguments opportunity for learning rather than for division. This sets the stage for discovery, which in the cases that it applies is a shared recognition that they've been engaging in an interrelationship type of defense, and that what they really want is to get to a place where they're closer to one another, oftentimes the way they were earlier on in their relationship. That shared discovery deepens the process of repair. And a lot of times when couples have had difficulty for a long time, they've grown dissociated, very distant, lonely. There's been a lot of hurt. There's a lot of hurt to work through. And when people do that, they start to feel more empowered. They see that rather than being helpless and hurt over and over again and having conversations that don't seem to lead anywhere, they start to make progress. They start to get some traction in their problems. They start to have more positive experiences with each other. And it opens up the dissociation so that they can see more choices, more alternatives that they had. And they start to do different things, both in terms of how they actually spend their time, but also in terms of, more importantly, how they relate with one another. And they start to experience a greater sense of mutuality throughout the whole process. And in the book, we give examples of couples who actually work through this dream sequence and exercises at the end of every chapter to help guide people so they can work on it with someone close to them.
And let's take a telephone call or two from listeners. Daniel in Palm Beach Gardens. Hey.
Hi, it's great to be on the air with you guys. A very, very interesting conversation. And I just had a question because something that you said really struck a thought. You're talking about sort of directing inheritance. I mean, we've learned from Darwin that the fittest survive and the traits that are passed on are those that are able to adapt. But you seem to be suggesting that we can transmit our way of being through our environmental experience. Are you suggesting that maybe we got the Darwinian theory wrong? I mean, can we all of a sudden, before we have kids, start to change the way that we are and be less anxious and in that way transmit less anxiety to our children? Is that what you're kind of getting at with that observation?
Dr. Brenner?
Yeah, Daniel, that's a great question. So the Darwinian model means that you can't transmit anything directly. There was a fellow named Lamarck who also had a theory of evolution. That would be like if the trees grew higher, then the giraffes would immediately grow longer necks. And that was debunked for a long time. But epigenetic factors do allow learning from the parents and the grandparents to be immediately passed on. Now, for an epigenetic thing to work, the caveat here is that it has to happen before the child is born because it affects the way the DNA in the gamete, in the sperm or the egg, is read or not read. So there's a really interesting example of this with mice. They exposed a grandfather mouse before it had a litter to a fearful stimulus, like a cat or the smell of a cat. And then they observed what happened with the children and the grandchildren, and they found that both the children and the grandchildren of that grandparent mouse, that grandfather mouse, had behaviors of avoiding that kind of threat without ever having been exposed to it. So they had behavioral changes. They had changes in the way the brains of those mice were wired. So there were anatomic changes. And they had changes in the way that their genes were masked.
Okay, Daniel, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, very interesting.
And let's move along to, this is Linda in Miami. We're a little short on time,
yes,
Linda.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I mean, honestly, I can't even believe I'm driving around and this comes out of nowhere, and it's almost exactly verbatim the relationship that I'm having right now, which is coming to its natural conclusion after almost 10 years, I mean, to the day. So just a couple of interesting insights that I've been able to gather up trying to analyze myself and why I was stuck in this relationship for so long. In this case, my husband is the audience. I'm the performer. And it does definitely go back to, I think, childhood trauma. My husband's mother was negligent, and he ended up being raised up by an extremely abusive grandfather figure. So his father wasn't around either, and both parents kind of skipping out on him. The time that he was with his mother was fraught with all sorts of abuse, physical, mental, emotional. And then he went on to live with his grandfather and just went through even more abuse. And growing up with that has become a counter-dependent. So extremely, you know, independent. I don't need anyone. I don't, you know, I can do everything on my own, whatever. My story is that my father wasn't around, and not because, you know, he didn't want to be, he couldn't be. And so I was raised up the first 19 years of my life without even meeting my father. And then I finally was able to meet him and have some type of a relationship. But by that point, the only male figure I'd ever had in my life was my son. And so it was the perfect storm. You know, here was a man without a mother, and here was a mother, you know, who only had a boy, didn't have a father figure, never had a man really take care of her or even understand what it meant to have a strong man in one's life and understanding the value of that. And so it was the perfect storm when we got together. So it was me trying to rescue him and him continuously, you know, he, you know, five steps forward, three steps back. I mean, now after 10 years, my husband's gone from a drug addict living literally on, you know, in an apartment in the Bronx on a mattress to being an executive chef at a three-star restaurant. Mm.
Let's hear what the doctor has to say, Linda, because we're a little short on time. I'm sorry to interrupt
you.
It's a really interesting situation, though. Doctor?
Yeah, thank you for sharing your story. It's unfortunately not an unfamiliar story, and that's one of the reasons why we wrote the book. We're hoping that people can head that off at the pass, maybe sometimes salvage relationships, but at least get some understanding so that for the next relationship they can enter it with eyes wide open and some new tools.
We've been speaking with Dr. Grant Brenner. He's a psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, and consultant in private practice in New York City. He specializes in treating mood and anxiety disorders and the complex problems arising from developmental childhood trauma. And he's on the faculty of the Mount Sinai Beth Israel Department of Psychiatry. He's the co-author with Dr. Mark Borg Jr. and Daniel Berry of Irrelationship, How We Use Dysfunctional Relationships to Hide from Intimacy. Dr. Brenner, thank you so much for your time today and for your subject.
Yeah, thank you, Bonnie and Joseph. And people can learn more at our website, irrelationship.com, download a sample of the book, or look on Amazon. Find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. And lastly, we have some informative videos on YouTube that discuss these things with people giving real-world examples.
Okay, Food and Dining. Thank you so much.
Food and Dining is next.
Take care.
This summer, you can discover your creative side at the Boca Raton Museum Art School. New short classes start May 31st. You can take a day or evening art class in subjects like drawing, jewelry making, photography, or pottery. The art school is located at 801 West Palmetto Park Road in Boca Raton. You can learn more at bocamuseum.org/artschool.
Orchestra Miami presents Brundibar, an opera for kids, which became both a symbol of hope and resistance, as well as a Nazi propaganda tool. Three performances only, beginning May 15th at Pinecrest Gardens. Information at orchestramiami.org. Every Monday, you can enjoy the Arch Center Farmers Market at 1300 Biscayne Boulevard from 4 to 8:30 p.m., featuring fresh and local produce, prepared foods, and a farm-to-table dinner at Books and Books. Metered lot parking available. Details at archcenter.org.
Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. It's Food and Dining Thursday.
Indeed it is.
Always a favorite time for you and me, Joe.
Of course, it's the start of our weekend, so to speak.
That's right. Well, Linda Gassenheimer is with us now, the illustrious chef, author, syndicated columnist.
Yes, illustrious.
Today's topic is quite simple, but has its place in American culture, for sure. So we'll learn more now from Linda and today's special guests.
Well, Bonnie, thank you for the illustrious introduction. So, burgers. Burgers, they're a real American favorite. And they can range, you know, have you seen them? They could be $3, they could be over $100 or even more. So you add some beer, and we've got an American festival, don't you think? So everyone makes burgers, but it's not easy to make a really great one that's juicy, that's not overcooked. So here to give us some secrets, she's going to tell us how to make a perfect burger. It's Lori Grasty.
Grasty, that's correct.
Grasty.
Yeah.
She's the director of operations for two very popular burger restaurants, Kush, that's K-U-S-H, and Local, L-O-K-A-L. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, we're very excited you're here. You brought us burgers. And not to leave out the beer, David Rodriguez, he's the missionary of beer for the Wynwood Brewing Company, and he's here to tell us all about craft beer and draft beer, correct?
That's right. Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here to fill the studio with a little something from his brewery. And we, of course, love to hear from you, our listeners. What's your favorite burger or beer? Do you have any questions or suggestions for our guests? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN.
Or email radio at WLRN.org. But there's more.
There is more. How about Tasker?
How about it?
Okay. Our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype. And Fred writes the wine suggestions for my Dinner in Minutes columns that you can read in the Miami Herald. And you can read his wine column in Saturday's Miami Herald food section. Fred, what are we drinking today? Wine, beer, both? What's up? Are you with us, Fred? Well, we'll get Fred in a minute.
Yeah, we'll maybe make a he call ran out. We'll make an out call then.
Maybe he went ran out to get a beer. Heard that we were going to be drinking beer here. Okay, Lori, Kush. That seems like an unusual name for a burger restaurant. K-U-S-H, what is that?
So actually, owner Matthew Kusher, that was his childhood name. So all of his friends wound up calling him Kush all throughout high school and elementary school. So we figured it was just perfect for the name for the restaurant.
It's right up the street from our studios.
Correct, yes. Yeah. It's a few blocks right up the street.
Okay, so we have Fred now. Fred, are you with us?
I don't know, am I? I heard you perfectly already.
Yeah, okay. He's with us already.
Well, you're with us now. Okay, so is it going to be beer, wine, or both, Fred?
Well, I think I'll talk to David about his beer. I like beer.
Okay, that sounds good. So, okay, Lori, what goes into making a really great burger?
Well, with our beef, we get everything local. So it comes from a farm up in Ocala, Florida. And they basically give a lot of TLC to the cattle. So we have our grass-fed and regular beef. They don't do any hormones, antibiotics, or anything along those lines. So that's what's most important is the type of beef that we're getting from the farm.
But now, do you get it ground or do you grind it yourself?
We grind it in-house every day, fresh.
So that makes a real big difference when
yes.
it's fresh like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, so you have many different types of burgers in your menu. And we've had a couple right here.
Can I try one?
Yeah, it's okay now, Joe. Hey, Joe, you've been good. You didn't try it yet. Wow.
It's because he wasn't hungry yet.
I see. Okay. So what is he eating?
There we go.
Oh, nice.
Tell us which
this
one did you...
It says bacon.
Okay, the bacon
Oh, I believe
one.
That's actually the Frida by Kush. So that has Gruyere cheese, potato sticks, guava jelly, which is kind of our take on the Cuban sandwich.
Okay.
So...
Guava, yeah, it's really good.
Well, why is it called Frida?
Frida by Kush, it goes with the guava jelly. That was one thing that Matt was very known for when he was a kid as well, was putting guava on everything.
Okay, so I don't understand the Frida part still, but that's okay. all right, so there's another burger here we have,
okay,
which is really, really delicious.
It's nice and medium rare.
Mm-hmm. And Joe's digging in. So what is he having, Lori?
That is the Johnny Utah that was actually voted best burger in Miami. So that has pastrami, cheddar, lettuce, tomato, diced onions, and our local sauce, which is made in-house as well.
Nice blend with the onions.
But in addition to the pastrami and everything else, there is a beef burger.
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
There's a burger in there as well.
Now, do you have a fat-to-meat ratio that you use? Or?
No, it's just everything that we wind up grinding in-house, so we don't have an
Whatever
actual ratio.
Whatever you come up with.
Correct, that is correct.
Lori, is the locale supposed to be like local, L-O-C-A-L, or is it supposed to also be low-calorie, or does that have anything to do with low-calorie?
No, a lot of people do think that. Locale is actually a German word, which means meeting place pub.
Okay.
So, and in Spanish, it also means the pub as well, so that's why we went with that word, and to be local.
Okay.
So it's L-O-K-A-L.
Right.
Correct,
right.
Yes.
So, and so
there's
now
some sweet potato fries, too.
Yeah, there's something else there.
Yes, I know.
Yes, did you taste it?
Yes, I did, yeah.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
You
okay.
did?
Okay. Wow.
How was it?
Tell us, it's a very
good.
A very Florida.
Very Florida, yes.
Yes. What are we talking about, Lauren?
With the alligator strips. That is one of the most popular items that we have on our menu is the alligator strips. We get those local from a farm in Florida as well.
I just want everyone to know that it's a law here that that all animals have to be bred and farmed. It's not a wild alligator.
Correct.
Yes. So, but it's kind of spicy coating on it. What is that?
That's the Old Bay seasoning that we put into the the batter as well.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have to have dessert.
Of course.
That you brought.
Yes,
so
I did bring some key lime pie, which we also were voted for best key lime pie in Miami. We make everything in-house from all of our sauces to our desserts. And so the crust is made in-house as graham cracker and pecans.
Mm. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So now you have two restaurants and you're opening a third? Tell us about that.
That is correct. We're opening Spillover. It will be opening actually this Monday. We're right now in training with all of our staff. It's going to be a local seafood concept and we're focusing on ciders and meads, which are very popular in Europe.
So Spillover.
Meads, that's the ancient stuff, isn't it?
That's a honey wine, yes. That's where it comes from. It's a honey wine.
Yes, all the monasteries in England used to have it. So where is that going to be?
That's actually going to be in Coconut Grove. It's a few blocks down from Locale now as well. It's right across from the old Improv in Coconut Grove.
Okay, and Spillover because you're crowded in the other one?
Well, that's exactly what our original name was going to be. We were trying to have a concept next to Locale, and it was going to be the Spillover guest going into that second restaurant. Unfortunately, that fell through, but we really liked the name, so we continued with that name for Spillover.
Okay. Well, we have a call. Is that Randy in Boca Raton?
Randy in Boca, yeah.
Yes. Hi, Randy. You're on the air.
Hello. Quick question. Now, lately I've been going into some burger places, and I see these really exotic meats. Anything from Kobe to alligator to elk to moose. I'm just kind of wondering what your guests may think of these exotic meats.
Well, the most exotic meat that we do is the gator burger. Everything else is pretty much just the regular beef that we have there. But we do have the gator burger, and all of our guests love it. One of our most popular is also the veggie burger, which is made nothing from any type of animals, all from the vegetables. So we just try to do a different take on all of our burgers. But anything that we produce, everyone really is happy with.
How do you hold the vegetables together?
The vegetable with oat bran. That's how it all comes together.
Okay. With oat bran.
Correct.
And Bonnie, you were asking about that. And what about this elk and other kinds of meats?
We don't have any of that. That's more popular up north. I'm originally from Pennsylvania, and you saw a lot of that with the gamey meat up there. But down
ostrich
here,
they used to have.
Yes, they have that up there. That's more popular up north.
So, Randy, what's your take on that?
I haven't really tried them, to be honest with you. But I know I see places that have the Kobe beef, which is probably twice as expensive as the other meats. I've had it. I can't really taste that big a difference. Is the Kobe beef worth the additional price?
I would say it all depends on what restaurant you're at and where you get it from. It is more expensive. It's the way that they take care of the cattle. We currently don't have any of the Kobe beef. We just deal with the local farm. So, you know, it all depends on the cattle that's coming in. And it is more pricey and the meat is more tender. But, you know, we still have that with our grass-fed beef as well.
Okay,
thanks for your call.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking about burgers, and we're about to talk about beer. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. I feel the
earth move. Before she became a pop music superstar, she wrote the songs that would shape a generation. Her name was Carol King. Her story is beautiful. Broadway's Tony and Grammy Award-winning musical. Beautiful, the Carole King Musical, coming to the Broward Center May 10th through 22nd. Tickets available at browardcenter.org. You're beautiful
as you feel. Conserve Art offers professional restoration and conservation of fine art and collectibles for museums and collectors. Custom framing and insurance claims handling are a specialty. Information is online at conserveart.net.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This election season, presidential candidates Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders have attracted a lot of support with big sweeping proposals to tear down existing systems and start from scratch. We'll look at the psychology behind why voters relate, the appeal of the clean slate over tinkering with existing systems. That's next time on Here and Now.
Stay tuned. Here and Now begins at 2 o'clock, 15 minutes from now.
We're funded by WLRN members and by Comcast Business. Businesses depend on the Internet and need service that they can depend on. Comcast Business, Internet, Voice, and TV. Built for business.
we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we've been talking about one of America's favorite foods, that's burger, with Lori Grasty. I said it right this time?
Yes, that is correct.
Yes, Director of Operations for Kush and Locale Restaurants. And now we're going to be talking with David Rodriguez. He's the missionary of beer for the Wynwood Brewing Company. And we've been talking about great burgers. I guess we're going to talk about great beer.
You got it.
But before we do, it's dinner in minutes time. So here's a quick and easy burger. How's that? It's a buffalo burger, and I make it with ground buffalo meat. And you can buy buffalo meat in the supermarkets today. And what I do is I mix a little barbecue sauce into the ground meat, and it gives kind of a barbecue flavor. So you can have that without heating up your grill. And it's a lower-fat burger, and it keeps it very moist. So sauté some onions and mushrooms in the same skillet with the burger. The secret to a juicy burger, we haven't talked about that yet, Lori, is to keep it light. So don't handle it too much. Don't pat it. And when you put it on the grill or your pan, don't mash it down with a spatula or something. Just let them be nice and light and tasty. And then, of course, you would put the burgers on a bun and the onions and the mushrooms on top. Couldn't be bad. So everybody's shaking their head here. This is not television, so I have to tell everybody.
Are you toasting your buns?
You can toast my hamburger buns, yes. Okay. There's a tomato and onion salad to go with that. So you just slice up some tomatoes and you sprinkle some diced red onion on top. Drizzle a little dressing. The complete recipe and a photo, it's on my website. That's dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. Fred Tasker. We already know what we're drinking today?
Yes, we do. We're drinking beer. David, you have a great title, Missionary of Beer. I wish I could become a missionary.
He kind of looks like a missionary
of
beer.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it's, you know, proclaiming the good word that there's a lot of great local craft beer out there. And, you know, us at Wynwood Brewing, we make some really fine beer, and it's just getting it to the people.
Yeah, you opened in 2013, and I understand your beers are so popular that they're selling faster than you can make them, and you're looking to expand. Is that right?
That's correct. We're in a good position right now because, you know, it's the beer is phenomenal. It's selling very quickly, and we're just about fully maximized space-wise in our current facility in Wynwood, so now we're looking to grow, you know, to at least 30,000 square feet and have a large 50-barrel brew house that's going to be automated. So the demand is real.
So you've got
that's a lot of beer.
But you've got your shop and your brewery right there, all in one place.
Correct. Our current facility is in Wynwood, where we brew the beer, where we have a tap room, so guests can come on in and enjoy a pint and watch through our window, almost like an open kitchen. Our brewers make the beer as they enjoy it.
So it's almost like having a tour of the beer.
Essentially.
Yeah. Oh, good.
David, over the decades that I was in Miami, I wrote a dozen times about microbreweries opening, and then a few months later, I would write about them closing. It seemed that back in the 90s, Miami just wasn't ready for them. What's changed?
Well, you know, I think you have to look at the people and what they're doing. I mean, I think it's piggybacking off of the slow food movement, where you're wanting to get farm-to-table food and locally sourced ingredients like Kush does. The same starting to apply for beer, because beer is very popular in the Northeast and in the Midwest, and even in the Pacific Northwest. And Miami is really the last large metropolitan city to have a craft brewery identity. But now people are starting to realize they want to eat and drink local, and we're that local drinking component.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And now, back in the 90s, I asked one of the brewers what the secret was of the most popular craft beer he made. And he said it was the one that he brewed on purpose to taste as much as possible like a Bud Light. So I guess we weren't very sophisticated then.
Fred, you just stabbed him in the heart.
Yeah. It's okay. My beard covers my heart. So no, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, being a craft brewery, it's important to us, you know, to make locally sourced, you know, beer that has flavor, that has variety, that has aromas. You know, we're very different than we make, you know, blonde ales, we make porters, pale ales. So there's a lot of variety and flavor and color and taste, and that's what really attracts people to try different things.
So Fred,
now, when you get into craft beers, you tend to get into hoppy flavors. And the bitter hoppy flavor of a beer is measured in IBUs, which is International Bitterness Units. And you have one, the highest one you have is 70 IBUs for one of your beers, and that's your IPA. That's pretty sophisticated stuff.
It is, and you know, most.
You think Miami's ready for that?
I think they are, because most craft, you know, most beer drinkers in general have been devoid of hoppy beers. They've been used to drinking, you know, a lot of large name domestics.
For those people who may not know, could you tell us what a hoppy beer is?
Yeah, sure. I mean, a hoppy beer, when you use hops, they give you bitterness, flavor, and aroma to a beer, and that bitterness helps balance the sweetness of the malt, whereas IPA stands for India Pale Ale. It's traditionally, it's a historical beer that was brewed in England and shipped to India, and to help it survive the voyage, you added hops because they were a natural preservative along with a higher alcohol content.
All right. So now, Fred, I just wanted to say that we've got some beer here in the studio. And it's really interesting. And tell us what we're drinking here.
Sure. Well, we're drinking here. We got La Rubia Blonde Ale. It is our most popular beer we make at Wynwood.
It's the light one.
It is the light one. Yep.
Yes.
Rubia stands for blonde in Spanish. And it's a very approachable, easy drinking beer, very refreshing. And we brewed it specifically to cater to the South Florida climate. So it's, you know, on a hot day, you could, you know, enjoy this beer very much so.
It is
David,
delicious.
Can you pair a few of your brews with particular burgers that you've been talking about? Maybe what beer would go with that alligator burger?
Yeah, well, I mean, the alligator strips, because they have, you know, that Old Bay and they have some spice to it, you could actually get away with doing La Rubia as kind of a contrast pairing, because La Rubia is very light and effervescent, and it's going to kind of cleanse your palate before every bite. Now, if you want to do a comparison pairing, you would go with an IPA like the Wynwood IPA, because you could dip it in that nice, that garlicky, spicy sauce there that's going to give you some bite, and the IPA's bitterness is going to match that.
So, Fred, you should be very happy, because now we're having scrubbing bubbles like you love to have.
Oh, that's, yeah, you know, beer does the same job as champagne a lot of the time.
I figured that.
Well, you have an emailer, Fred. It's Kathleen and Carl Gables, who says, okay, Fred, we all know about beer and burgers, but tell the truth. Nothing goes with burgers better than champagne. My choice would be a Pinot Noir-based sparkling rosé brut. Now, would you recommend a brut, extra dry, or a rose champagne, or another sparkler?
Well, I guess if you're going to go with a rosé, I'd recommend a brut one, because the burger is pretty hefty stuff.
Okay.
All right. And Fred, we have...
That's not a bad idea, actually.
So, Fred, we have another one that I happen to like, and there's a reason why. Tell them what the other one is.
All right. Well, the
he's
other beer.
Pouring it as we go.
Yeah, let me guess. I'll bet it's a chocolate beer.
No.
Pretty close.
Close. Now, this beer we have is called Apple of My IPA, and it's a treatment based on our IPA recipe. So, we take a finished IPA beer that we make, the Wynwood IPA, and we add apples, vanilla, and cinnamon to give it a very, you know, nuanced flavor of apple pie without the sweetness. So it's a very unique beer. Again, you get an apple pie in a glass, essentially.
That's a little bit like the pumpkin ales that are popular around Thanksgiving, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah. So, now, go ahead, Fred. Sorry.
Florida state laws used to be pretty restrictive about beer and the sizes of containers it could come in and all that. Is it easier now, or are they still making problems for you?
You know, it is easier. Thankfully, the 64-ounce growler legislation passed last July. Before, you were only allowed to have a 32-ounce growler, which is a to-go container you fill at a brewery or a bar, or 128-ounce.
We need to define some of these terms. Growler.
Sure. Yeah, a growler is a glass container, a glass bottle that is refillable. So you purchase the container, you can then bring it to a brewery where it's cleaned out and filled for you, or a bar.
So you keep your glass bottle and you can keep going back for more.
And you just pay for the refill. That's it.
Now, 64 ounces, how many bottles of beer is that?
64 ounces is 4 16-ounce pints. It's a half gallon. But what's interesting with Florida is you could only do a quart of beer prior to last July, or a gallon. And they said that, you know, a half gallon is too excessive, but, well, you get
Why
a gallon.
Why about a gallon?
Exactly. A very old law that didn't make any sense. And now we, you know, 64-ounce growlers are the most common size in the country.
So that's really helping the craft breweries.
It sure is. Because, I mean, you know, if you pop a gallon of beer, you're going to want to drink it with a good group of friends or some thirsty people, because you can't then reseal it effectively to hold carbonation and flavor.
Okay. Right. So we have another couple of terms here, craft versus draft.
Well, yeah, draft beer, that's just the method of which you're serving the beer. So whether if it's in a bottle, it's considered package. If it's draft, it's on a tap system, you know, pushed through with CO2. And then, yeah, just craft beer just represents, really a movement of beer that shows you use high-quality ingredients to amplify unique flavors. You're drinking beers that vary in color, that vary in taste, that vary in aromas and alcohol contents. Some are stored in barrels. So it's a variety of different beers that, you know, help and contribute flavors to what you normally would be eating, you know, or drinking a beer with.
Now, David, where can listeners buy your beers in South Florida?
We are all over Miami-Dade, primarily a little bit of Fort Lauderdale. I mean, of course, you go by Kush and Locale. They're good friends of ours, and they've been supporting us since day one. But if you want to buy bottles or off-premise, you're talking Milam's Market, like in the Grove. You're talking Whole Foods, Total Wine, Fresh Market, a lot of independent liquor stores. And you could more readily find them available on draft at a lot of craft beer bars and restaurants.
How widely are you distributed around Florida?
Well, because of our demand and our production, you know, we're brewing the most we've ever made, but it's not enough to meet demand. So we're really limited to Miami-Dade County, a little bit of Monroe County in the Florida Keys, and parts of Broward County and Fort Lauderdale. But hopefully with our expansion, we'll be able to expand to the rest of the state.
Okay. Well, you know, this has been so fabulous. Burgers and beer, we've been
indeed
stuffing ourselves here, but we're just out of time. It's been really a very tasty week. Thank you, Lori Grasty, for joining us and for the delicious food. Kush is located, where is that, 203 North?
2003 North Miami Avenue.
In Wynwood.
Yes.
And Locales in the Coconut
Grove. Correct.
Right. And thank you, David Rodriguez, for joining us and for the tastings you've brought.
Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Fred Tasker, great advice. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Okay, Joe and Bonnie, you ate well today.
Yes, we did.
Thank you.
And we're sorry for the people we couldn't get to on the phone calls. So anyway, I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and thanks for joining us.
And that wraps us up today. Our producer, Richard Ive, technical direction from Michael Stock. Polly Landis is associate producer, and we always have free audio archives of our programs at our website, wlrn.org. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, it's Science Friday with host Ira Flatow. Bonnie and I return Monday with a program about the origin of America's gun culture. Historically, what made Americans so seemingly attached to firearms? And the calendar, May 12th, on this day in 1820, 196 years ago, the birth of Nurse Supreme Florence Nightingale in Italy, hence her first name. She often carried with her a pet owl. And on this day in 1925, 91 years ago, the birth of Lawrence Peter Barra in St. Louis, Yogi. He died last September. He won 3 MVPs in his 19-year New York Yankee career. Always go to other people's funerals, otherwise they won't go to yours. And one more while we polish up our 7 dirty words. On this day in 1937, 79 years ago, the birth of comedian George Carlin in New York. He was present at one of the arrests of Lenny Bruce and taken to jail in the same squad car. George Carlin died in 2008 at age 71. So we leave with words from George Carlin's hippy-dippy weatherman, Al Sleet. And tonight's forecast, dark. Continued dark throughout most of the evening with some widely scattered light towards morning.
Sorry, I didn't know I was supposed to laugh.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.